From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start in Mexico City, parts of which were untouched by Tuesday's earthquake, but all of which is focused on the rescue efforts that continue, especially at that school where a student is still alive but trapped. NPR's international correspondent Carrie Kahn lives there and is there, and Carrie, want to start at that school? It's become sort of the girl in the well writ large, you know, the story in America about the rescue of a little girl who fell down a well. There have been other rescues in Mexico, but the attention seems to have focused laser tight on this 12-year-old in the rubble.
It really has. It's become a focal point for a lot of the pain that Mexicans are feeling. You talk to people anywhere all over the city, they're just gripped by the story of that school. And it's just heartbreaking. You know, just hundreds of volunteers have flooded to the area. There's just more people there than work can be done. And the Marines are there, soldiers are there doing the work with the heavy machinery. But all eyes in the country are focused on that school right now.
And you see these human chains we've talked about passing things along that are needed, like these huge poles that are still holding up parts of the school because there's a fear of collapse, not just at the school, but elsewhere.
Right. There are damaged apartment buildings all over the place and people can't get back into their apartments. And so there's brigades that go by with these huge wooden wedges that they're putting up to hold up facades, to hold up balconies. And everybody just wants to help. It's just inspiring. It's sad. It just feels like everybody wants to be part of the rescue effort. Yet, you know, you really can't be in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, those areas are chaotic. No one's in charge. Everyone's in charge. And it just, it's a difficult situation.
Well, we hear about parents who use the messaging service WhatsApp to communicate with kids who were still trapped and find out kind of, you know, where they were in relation to doors so that rescuers could find them. And just terrible. And then that moment we just want to touch on where when a child is found, the rescuers yell the name out and everyone in the crowd chants it.
You see a lot of spontaneous gestures like that happening all over. What happens at these rescue sites where the buildings collapsed? And in Mexico City, I think the latest figure is over 35 buildings have collapsed. And what happens is people start wanting to hear and listen if they can hear any sign of life under the rubble. So people put up their fist in the air. Somebody screams silence, and then everybody's fist goes up in the air, and it looks like just... It's to gesture people to be quiet, but it also looks like people are really throwing their hearts into that fist pump into the air, just for everybody to stand together. There's been spontaneous song that has broken out. I was just traveling down the street and saw these trucks filled with volunteers, and they come up along another truck filled with tons of volunteers, and they all just start chanting, Mexico, Mexico. People are just heartbroken and feeling the solidarity and just feeling overwhelmed and sort of helpless, too, at the same time.
I know you were traveling when the earthquake took place, but your husband and two children were there and are there now. Your husband out helping. Your teenagers have gone out. Isn't there also fear, though, that things could still fall, that there could be tremors?
Definitely. There hasn't been a really strong aftershock, which is surprising. Everybody seems to be on edge. There's been a lot, but nothing really strong. You know, I was in the earthquake after Haiti, and there was a 7.1 aftershock after that earthquake. But people here are on edge, just waiting for that next jolt, because the jolt was so terrifying. It lasted for so long, and it just shook everything from the core. And you go by some of these buildings that you see teetering. You know, Mexico City is built on this dry lake bed. It's like rocking jello, the feeling people describe the ground underneath them. But what they do is they just put up some yellow police tape around these buildings that look like they're teetering, and you could see huge cracks in them. And you walk around them. You're just walking off the sidewalk in the street, and you're like, oh my God, this could fall at any moment. And yesterday, every time we went down a new street, somebody would say, there's another building down. And getting home last night from the school took me, I think it was about 2 hours, because people were in the streets, blocking off the streets, telling people all of a sudden, shut off your engine. We're trying to listen for signs of life. It's very stressful with that sort of edge on it. Will there be another aftershock? And will more buildings go down?
Well, and so just this is so compelling. But what's the sense of how long this takes or what's next? We're hearing, you know, at least 60 children from that school went to the hospital. Is the hospital okay? People are shouting out for, here's a quote, we need clonazepam, insulin, anesthetics, antihistamines, and oxygen tanks. You know.
Oh, people were coming up to me constantly yesterday with long lists of what they need. Some of them I didn't even know what they were talking about. But just I think that nobody's ready yet to go, you know, into that reconstruction phase. People are still in the recovery phase. And I think that's going to be a very hard turn for a lot of these people that are out in the street volunteering when they say, okay, we're done looking for survivors. You know, that moment, it's going to be very difficult. And to tell people this is going to be, you know, a reconstruction phase. No longer a rescue phase, but it's coming, and I think it's going to be a difficult time, and it's going to be a long time. It's going to be a long recovery.
Carrie Kahn, NPR's international correspondent, speaking to us from Mexico City. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to a story that is raising eyebrows in Washington. Politico is reporting that Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, who's known for wanting to cut government spending, is under scrutiny for taking costly private jets when he could have taken much less expensive commercial flights. Joining us via Skype is Politico reporter Dan Diamond. Hi, Dan.
Jeremy, how are you?
Doing well. And tell us more about exactly what you found when it comes to Tom Price's use of private jets.
What we found is that Tom Price is using charter jets to travel on routine business around the country. Not talking about trips to hurricane zones or other natural disasters, but trips as close as Washington to Philadelphia or up to a resort in Maine to attend a conference the next day. And this has been going on for some time, but we drilled in on five specific trips last week.
And by the way, for people who don't live in the Northeast, the trip from Washington to Philadelphia, you could drive it in a couple hours. You could take the train there in a couple hours. And if you fly, it's probably an hour or less. And there are a lot of commercial flights available to take you between Washington and Philadelphia.
They do run regularly. The commercial flight takes, we'll say, about an hour. The charter plane might take a little bit less. Price's plane took about 40 minutes on the way up and a little over an hour or so on the way back because they circled in the air. But the point is, these are two readily accessible metro areas, and previous secretaries and other top officials, like former Vice President Joe Biden, would take the train. Maybe they would take a car at times. At worst, they would take commercial planes because at the end of the day, the taxpayer tends to be footing the bill on this travel. And the charter jet round trip to Philadelphia, the owner of that plane told us, cost about $25,000. That's a lot for a short trip up and down the East Coast.
Well, and you think of somebody like the Secretary of Defense as somebody who would get their own plane, or the Secretary of State as somebody who would get their own plane. When did the Secretary of Health and Human Services start getting access to their own private plane, or is Price the first?
Price isn't the first secretary to use a charter jet, at least on occasion. We talked to former Secretary Sebelius, Barack Obama's first health secretary, who did use a charter flight once up in Alaska to get to a rural village that was otherwise not accessible. But that was the one occasion we could find across the 8 years of the Obama administration and two health secretaries. So don't want to say that he's totally groundbreaking by using a charter plane. It's the frequency and the routineness of it.
What has been the response from Price about your story?
This might not surprise you, Jeremy. We tried repeatedly to get comment from him, from his spokespeople. They finally said that he will take planes as necessary, given the emergency situation. They came out with a statement on Wednesday saying that his days are long and the travel department checks all possible commercial flights. So not denying our reporting, but rather trying to put a gloss on why he might be taking flights that cost tens of thousands of dollars, often per leg.
As you point out in your reporting, he's not the only member of the Trump administration who's under criticism for using jets like this. The Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin gained some notoriety for using a jet for travel that included a trip to see the eclipse this summer, and he reportedly requested a government plane to take him on his overseas honeymoon. As far as you know, are there any moves within the Trump administration to try to rein in some of this flying on private jets by cabinet members?
I don't know if they're comparing frequent flyer notes or talking collectively about how they are approaching this. But I do think it does speak to something different about this administration than the administrations that we've seen before. A lot of these folks haven't been in government. Mnuchin, this is his first time there. And if you are a Wall Street executive or a venture capitalist, perhaps you are used to the practice of taking charter jets. I know Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, takes charter jets but pays for them out of pocket. She's worth billions of dollars. That is something she can do. It's a little unusual in Tom Price's case. He's been in government. He was a congressman for 12 years. And while he has some wealth as an orthopedic surgeon, it doesn't appear that he has the ability to be paying for $60,000 worth of travel in one sample week. If he does, perhaps he's much more philanthropic toward the airline industry than we have evidence to believe so far.
That's Politico reporter Dan Diamond joining us via Skype from Washington. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And by the way, on the point about corporate executives using private jets, not anymore at GE. The Wall Street Journal reports this week that the company's executives will no longer fly using charter services in an effort to cut costs. Hurricane Maria continues its march through the Caribbean. There are hurricane warnings in the Dominican Republic, Turks and Caicos, and the Southeast Bahamas. Meanwhile, people are picking up the pieces in Puerto Rico. The prime minister of the island nation of Dominica says at least 15 people are dead there, many more missing. President Trump has approved a disaster declaration for the Virgin Islands, making federal funding available to people affected on the island of St. Croix. St. John and St. Thomas were declared disasters after they were badly damaged by Hurricane Irma 2 weeks ago. But Maria hit St. Croix. Joining us now is the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, Kenneth Mapp. Governor, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you. Thank you.
And tell us what the situation is there after Hurricane Maria.
Well, I had three islands, St. John, St. Thomas, and Water Island, devastated by Hurricane Irma, and St. Croix was our base for restoration and recovery. And then here came Maria, and Maria decided, well, she wanted a piece of the Virgin Islands as well, and so a good section of St. Croix and the West End really got hammered hard. I mean, the island was affected across the board, but the West End got hammered hard, so we are really right now making sure we check on our folks, make sure they're sheltered, they're fed, they're secure. We have a full curfew in the territory today, and I'm here working with the FEMA folks trying to make sure that we're reprovisioning more stuff to make sure we can feed our folks, give them water, and then we will turn our sight towards recovery and the rebuilding of the entire U.S. Virgin Islands.
Do you have a sense at this point of death toll or injuries?
No. I actually, in my meeting before I came to this interview, I asked a question about have folks been showing up at the hospital in any major ways with injuries, and I'm told not, similar to what it seems to have happened in St. Thomas. But I can make no official statement regarding injuries. We just not seen a lot of that. I was in the neighborhoods. I went in by Humvee and spent 6 hours in the western end of the island yesterday. And while I drove through the neighborhoods and over the trees, the amount of debris and roof damages are significant, but I didn't have folks reporting injuries or saying people there were hurt, and we haven't seen that showing up in numbers at the hospital yet. Death, no confirmation of any fatalities as of this moment.
Hmm. What about power outages on the island? Do you have power?
It's 100% out. Only 100%. Those folks with power generations have power. The hospital is generated. We do the hospitals and the airports completely underground, so they have power, but everywhere else is relying on their own standby generators while the power authority assess. The main distribution terminal from the plant where all those heavy power lines came down, that's damaged, so before they can get any place to have power, they've got to get that assessed and then repaired and start working on going out into the community.
So how long do you think it'll be before power is restored?
Well, power is not going to be restored in... that's a dual question, so let me think for a moment. I believe we'll start seeing pockets of power probably within the week, but power restoration across the entire island will take months.
What do you need at this point from the outside?
Well, we need help with our FEMA partners and our cruise ship partners. We're bringing in a lot of food, water, tarpaulins, personal hygiene packs, cots, and blankets. That's really the immediacy of the need. We're asking folks who can to go to usvirecovery.org, usvirecovery.org, and they can donate there. That's under the Community Foundation of the VI. It's a 501(c) entity that's been around for 30 years in the Virgin Islands, and they do all kinds of stuff to help the community, and we're coordinating donations there. But, you know, folks that like to put missions together, you know, we're asking them to think about food and water you know, cots, personal hygiene packs. We're going to soon have the DMATs, the Disaster Medical Assistance Teams, on the ground. We're expecting the C-17s to start arriving late this afternoon and this evening. I was able to speak to Administrator William Brock Long of FEMA and had a very good conversation with him, as well as the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, as we, you know, coordinate the relief for St. Croix.
What island in the U.S. Virgin Islands is in the worst shape at this point? Because as you mentioned, St. Thomas and St. John were hit in Irma and now St. Croix in Maria.
Well, I don't know. I know St. John is still the worst of it in terms of the extent of the damages. But the St. John and St. Croix and St. Thomas really hold a lot of the main infrastructure, particularly St. John is reliant on the infrastructure of St. Thomas, and we're working now today. They started back on power restoration there. St. Croix, we're just trying to fire up standby generators to water pumps and keep the city waters flowing and stuff like that. I can't tell you today which is the worst. It's worse in different pockets for many reasons, but it's just bad.
Hmm. What has this been like for you, Governor?
Well, I have the distinct honor of being on deck with two Cat 5s in 12 days.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure. You know, yesterday I was on 32 hours straight without sleep, and I was actually able to go and get a very hot shower and just lay down and sleep for 5 hours. And I truly got up much more refreshed today and much more focused. But I'll worry about me later as long as I can get a good chow in and get coordinate the efforts and get them done what need to be done and take care of the folks. I'll be fine. If I see progress for the folks, that really helps me. That helped me personally to continue to drive on adrenaline and do what I'm required to do.
That's Kenneth Mapp, who is the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Governor, we're thinking about you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope you get the help that you need.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You may have heard of Twinsburg, the small town in Ohio where thousands of twins flock every year in August for the Twin Days Festival. But scientists also make the trip, along with the FBI. Why is that? Jeffrey Delvisio of our partner STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, is here with more. And Jeff, you are an identical twin.
I am. My twin brother's name is Tom.
And he's a reporter as well?
Yep. So I pulled him in for this.
And for the scientific part of it, what is that?
So every year they have a research pavilion where a bunch of different researchers come, because ultimately the research subjects, normally they have to go out and find them. But here, you know, at Twinsburg, they come to them. Mm. The West Virginia University researchers have been coming for 8 years now. So this is a yearly pilgrimage for them.
Well, so distinguish for us, how are scientists using the identical twins?
Sure. You know, most twins grow up together, but there's a bit of environment that comes in and plays a factor on just how you develop as a person over time. So the idea is that the identical twins are a perfect natural experiment to test the difference between the contribution of genetics to the contributions of your environment to your development, your personality, your skin, your, you know, how you age, what diseases you get, all of that sort of stuff.
And how do fraternal twins viewed?
So they're actually a really good control because they're born at the same time, but they're two different eggs. So it's just like a normal two siblings, but they just happen to share a womb. So fraternal twins definitely factor into the research as well.
We'll talk about why the FBI is showing up at these events, because one of the greatest tests, I guess, of facial recognition is telling identical twins apart. So what are the FBI agents talking about?
So the FBI has been sponsoring research out of West Virginia University for a bunch of years now, and it's because West Virginia University has a big biometrics program. Now, just think about the new iPhone and facial scanning, that you can use your face as a password for the phone. Biometrics is just a program, computer programs, that go and recognize us by images, sometimes by voice print or fingerprints. Those are the sort of more typical biometrics programs. So the FBI has been sponsoring research to make their systems better, and twins are a great way, especially identical twins, a great way to really push the test, to push the programs to their limit. Can you tell the difference between those individuals?
Well, right. But can they? I mean, if identical twins are identical and have the same genetics, I mean, Apple is boasting that the new iPhone X does have a Face ID program. Some say the science isn't there yet. But can they distinguish between identical twins?
I mean, if you stare, I did a video for the piece, got a bunch of twins on there. If you look at them closely, you can tell there are small differences. And, you know, that slight variations really tax those computer programs. But if they're able to do it, and they've been able to faithfully, they were telling me that the research, they're getting better and better at having a computer be able to recognize faces, the differences between those two faces. They're getting better and better with the more data that they load in. And that's why they go to Twinsburg. They were able to do 450 different individuals over the course of the weekend. And so that's a great test for their systems to really prove that the computer can tell the difference.
Well, and so what do you think about Apple's claim?
I'd love to get an iPhone, a new iPhone, and test it with my twin brother. I'd really have to kind of see for myself.
I think for research purposes, they should give you one.
There you go.
That's Jeffrey Delvisio, a reporter for Stat. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's get to Puerto Rico, where thousands of people are assessing the damage from Hurricane Maria. Patricia Mazzei is a reporter with the Miami Herald. She's in San Juan. Patricia, first of all, do we know more about the extent of the damage in Puerto Rico at this point?
Well, we know that the government has had difficulty getting in contact with, you know, by phone or satellite phone or any sort of communications with much of the island. As of last night, they were hearing from Metro San Juan and from parts, eastern parts of the island, but the western side of the island where Maria went out was unreachable either by phone or by road. So we know that emergency management teams went out blind, essentially, to try to clear up roads and reach people.
So it's very difficult for the authorities to be able to reach people. We were speaking with a woman today in Puerto Rico who was trying to reach her mother and was unable to do that and said she couldn't, go anywhere because the roads were blocked in many cases.
Yeah, even in San Juan, getting around has been very difficult today. Believe it or not, there are traffic jams. Now, they have asked people not to go out on the street, but nobody is listening to that advice. And it's not just that there are roads covered with debris. We are finding that there are quite a few roads that are flooded. And if you get stuck on a strip of the city, you can maybe move east-west, but not north-south.
We heard yesterday that 100% of the power was out on Puerto Rico. Is that still the case?
I don't know if the latest number is still 100% because I've been out on the road as opposed to with the emergency managers. But I can tell you from what we see, very few places have generators, and we see power lines that are just horizontal on the ground. So right. I can only imagine what the rest of the island looks like in terms of the power grid. It did not fare well.
Is there a request at this point from Puerto Rico for help from the outside? What do we know about who's coming to the aid of those who have been affected by the storm?
Well, they have said before the storm that FEMA and other federal agencies were ready to step in. And in fact, we saw the National Guard save people from flash flooding late last night. We actually spoke to one man who had to leave his house, and the guard came in for him on a truck. The water started going up like at 1 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday. He didn't get rescued till about, you know, after 9 o'clock at night. So the National Guard is here, and the governor has said we have everything lined up. The question now is just getting it to the right places and hearing from the people who need that help the most.
I saw a tearful interview with the mayor of San Juan last night, who said that the real challenge was going to be that the people of Puerto Rico, who have just been through so much in recent years, whether they can step up and rebuild in Puerto Rico.
The people we have spoken to in San Juan all intend to rebuild. They certainly have a fighting spirit. I haven't heard anybody who's despondent. One renter told us he was definitely moving out of his house because it had been trashed and he had spent 6 hours in a bathroom riding out the storm. Hmm. But, no, I don't think, I've not heard anybody saying, you know, we're just going to leave Puerto Rico. They seem kind of resolute, even though some of them will tell you they didn't expect this storm to be as bad as it was because, you know, Irma wasn't as bad.
Right.
And so they thought maybe this one wouldn't be either, but this one was more the worst case scenario, and it played out.
That's Patricia Mazzei, a reporter with the Miami Herald, joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Patricia, thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
There have been snowballing stories this week about former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort's connections to Russia. Emails show that 2 weeks before Trump accepted the nomination, Manafort offered to provide briefings on the race to a Russian billionaire aligned with the Kremlin. It's well known that before the campaign, Manafort was hired to promote the Russia-backed president of Ukraine, who was deposed and opposed by the U.S. Now the New York Times is reporting Manafort's been hired to promote the Kurds in Monday's Kurdish independence referendum in northern Iraq, the area known as Kurdistan, a vote which is also opposed by the U.S. We'll keep an eye on the Russia investigation, but why would the U.S. oppose Kurdish independence? The Kurds supported the U.S. in Iraq and are fighting ISIS in Syria. The BBC's Paul Moss joins us from Kurdish Erbil in northern Iraq. And Paul, Kurdistan has been somewhat autonomous since the 1991 Gulf War, seeking full independence for decades. Now has hired the former Trump campaign chair. But remind us, what are the concerns of the U.S. about independence?
Well, the concerns of the U.S. are the same as Britain and indeed some other allies. What they're worried about is the fact that until now, the Kurds have been one of the most effective fighting forces taking on Islamic State. You may remember that when Islamic State first started taking cities, the Iraqi army were accused of, effectively, I'm afraid, running away, and it was suggested that the Kurdish forces, the so-called Peshmerga, they stood firm and indeed helped to retake towns from Islamic State. So what the US and Britain and others are worried about is that if Kurdistan breaks away, there will be a break in that alliance. You'll have the Iraqi National Army and the Kurdish forces working separately, but there's something else as well. The attempt to break away by Kurdistan is opposed by just about everybody in the region. I mean, ironically, it's managed to unite people who would never normally be united. Turkey's against it. Iran's against it. The Iraqi national government's against it. So all of these, if they were broken away from the Peshmerga, what Britain, America, and others are worried about is it'll make it easier for Islamic State to carry on because those fighting them will be more fractured.
We just heard from a reporter who was in Syria speaking with U.S. Special Forces who are backing the rebels and the Kurds fighting ISIS. And the U.S. Special Forces were thrilled about the fighting efforts of the Kurds, Kurdish women as well. And we're worried that the U.S. might be more concerned about its allies like Turkey, who, of course, are fearful of a Kurdish independent state on their border. But people in Erbil are already celebrating. They assume the vote will be yes. Here's a clip from a man you spoke with.
We've been waiting for this day forever. I was 14 years old when I was arrested by Saddam Hussein and badly tortured. On Monday, we will feel rebirth.
And we remember Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds in 1988 at the end of the Iraq-Iran war. So what happens, Paul, if, you know, there's this great thrilling vote and it doesn't lead to anything?
Well, I should say, you know, they're already assuming that the vote's going to lead to something. I mean, you heard that man talking. That was at a wild party I was at, a complete celebration. It was very bizarre. I mean, normally you do wait until after a vote before you celebrate the result. These guys were celebrating way ahead of time. So your question, what happens if it doesn't go anywhere, is a very good one, because as we speak, there is speculation that the vote could still be postponed. There are frantic negotiations going on between Kurds and the national government in Iraq. What the Kurdish regional government is looking for is some kind of concession or collection of concessions by the Iraqi national government, perhaps turning Iraq into some loose federation, perhaps even a promise that if they hold a referendum further down the line, then the Iraqi government would respect the result and respect an attempt at independence, whereas now the Iraqi government is saying this referendum is unconstitutional, do not do it, we will not respect the result.
Well, that is one thing. But remind us, Paul, why Turkey is so dead set against a Kurdish nation. Is it believed that there are separate factions of Kurds?
On the one hand, Turkey has a huge Kurdish population within its borders, and there has been a long-standing movement for separation by these Kurds, fought in a very violent way. The PKK is the name of the Kurdish separatists in Turkey. So yes, Turkey is very worried that if there was an independent Kurdish state here in Iraq, well, that would encourage the Kurds within its own borders. But here's the thing. Until now, Turkey has been a very big ally of the Kurds in northern Iraq. They have a very good economic relationship. The oil, which is being brought out of the ground here in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, is being piped out of Kurdistan through Turkey.
Well, in fact, we should say that's been a criticism, that it's all about the oil, that the U.S. and others don't want that oil to be in an independent state.
That is one accusation, but you see it goes both ways, because some oil companies have been very happy to do deals with Kurdistan directly, because as far as they're concerned, Kurdistan, even an independent Kurdistan, is a far safer bet than Iraq, because Iraq as a country is full of terrorist attacks, speculation that the whole country could fall apart. So as far as some oil companies are concerned, they're very happy to support Kurdistan independence. Indeed, I talked to a leading Kurdish businessman recently, and he was very funny. He said, look, I want to have Kurdistan independence, because when I show my Iraqi passport, other companies say, not sure if we want to invest with you. If I had a Kurdistan passport, he said, people are like, oh yeah, Kurdistan, the Peshmerga, that nice stable place with Erbil, this modern city. So he thinks it's a better bet, and so do a lot of people from a business point of view.
That's the BBC's Paul Moss from Erbil in northern Iraq. Paul, thank you.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
Well, now another story that's been pushed from the headlines by weather, the refugee crisis, which will probably be made worse by weather. But we have a story of refugees from Burundi in Africa adjusting to life in Louisville, Kentucky, with the help of a new farm startup. Roxanne Scott from member station WFPL has their story.
Joseph Kashamara has his light denim shirt rolled up at the sleeves. Wearing tall black rubber boots, he fills up a large watering pot. Kashamara's day job is packing metal in boxes for an aluminum company. But when he's done with work, he comes to the New Hope International Farm to work on an acre of land.
I feel so happy to be here with other friends in the evening.
Kashamara came to Louisville 2 years ago with his wife, five sons, and daughter. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo and was in a refugee camp in neighboring Burundi. More than 90% of the landlocked Burundi's labor force works in agriculture. And there aren't many places in Louisville that Burundian refugees can put their farming skills to use. That's why the growers organized around founding a farm last year.
The majority are from Burundi, but everybody's welcome.
Victor Eddy manages the farm, which is part of Common Earth Gardens, an organization that supports 10 other farms for refugees in the area. Eddy, who translates for Kashamara and other farmers in this story, says right now the New Hope Farm has 14 growers.
14, but they have families, so we are talking about 140 people benefiting from this garden.
Most of the farmers, like Kashamara, have day jobs.
When they was back home, they used to have a small garden and produce for their family, and if they produce more, they could sell.
Some of them have been farmers since they were teenagers. But there aren't many paid farming jobs in an urban city like Louisville. This small piece of land helps the refugees feed their families. But Benedicto Diaguva says it also reminds them of Burundi.
When I come here, the feeling of the nature, the sound of the bird, the trees, and the fresh air, that brings me a feeling of being home.
Part of that includes growing food native to Burundi. Joseph Kashamara points to a vegetable called mchicha, which is kind of like spinach.
It is very easy to make this because you cut it and you cut in small pieces. You put in water, you boil for a few minutes, and then it is ready for you to eat.
Sometimes, finding seeds for native Burundian produce isn't easy. Godfrey Barinizgie says he and other farmers drove 9 hours to North Carolina to buy seeds.
So I was calling friends and trying to talk to them and be able to know who can have those seeds. We need them, we are used to them, and they're good for our health.
Today, the harvesters are enjoying their first growing season. Tomorrow, growers like Joseph Kashamara want to expand their one-acre garden.
We don't want to
stop here. We want to add some animals like goats, chicken, or we can have some cow if possible.
They hope that what they plant today will lay the groundwork for their future and keep them connected to their roots. For Here and Now, I'm Roxanne Scott in Louisville.
Back now to one of our top stories, Hurricane Maria. Military flights will be allowed to land today at the main airport in San Juan, Puerto Rico. It had been shut down after Maria tore into the island yesterday and destroyed the electrical grid. Commercial flights will resume tomorrow. Herman Cuevas lives in a suburb of San Juan. He says his concrete home survived the storm, but the destruction around his neighborhood is worse than he expected.
The damage on the infrastructure has been very severe. The trees are down, or there's no leaves. Everything is brown. A lot of electrical cables on the ground. Even concrete poles are snapping half.
Cuevas says his family is getting power from a generator, but cell phone reception on the island is unreliable. And he says getting news or information from the government is near impossible because most of Puerto Rico's radio stations are not working. We will, of course, keep following this story as Puerto Rico and other islands recover from the storm. Well, as the sun set last night, Jews around the world began observing Rosh Hashanah. It marks the beginning of the new year in the Jewish calendar, in this case, the year 5778. It's also the beginning of a solemn period of reflection and renewal. Jeremy Fine is senior rabbi at Temple of Aaron in St. Paul, Minnesota. I spoke to him via Skype before the holiday began yesterday, and I started with the traditional greeting, Lashana Tova.
Shana Tova, Umituka, which means a sweet and happy new year.
Well, tell us about the meaning of this holiday.
Sure. So it's the beginning of the new year. We actually begin a process that will conclude with Yom Kippur or even the next holiday, which is called Sukkot, which is kind of, if you've ever lived near any religious Jews, you might see these little huts or booths that come up. But Rosh Hashanah is the beginning. It's the holiday. We begin repentance. Tshuva is the word in Hebrew. And we begin repenting for transgressions we may have committed or even some that we don't know that we've committed, but probably are everyday kind of human nature things. And so Jews come beginning tonight. A lot of times families will have dinners and then come to services. And the big day will be day one, which is Thursday. And then Friday as well, many, many Jews will celebrate this two-day holiday. And then it will lead into Shabbat as well. And Yom Kippur is in about 10 days.
And there are some traditional foods that are associated with Rosh Hashanah. What are those?
Absolutely. So the most notable is apples and honey. Honey for sweetness and apples because they go perfect with honey. But also because it's the time of year. There's also a challah, which is a traditional bread that we use throughout the year. But specifically on Rosh Hashanah, that challah is baked in a round shape. That is to show creation of the world and the circularness of life and starting over.
And as you mentioned, Yom Kippur is coming up. Is there a connection between these two holidays? Is there a reason why they're so close together?
Yeah, so there's 10 days in between them. They're called in Hebrew the Yamim Noraim. And these begins the repentance. And actually, we believe that kind of God at this time is judging who will live and who will die over the next year. And during these 10 days, we're kind of in like this extreme repentance, beginning on Rosh Hashanah, ending on Yom Kippur. And the book is sealed. The book of life is sealed on Yom Kippur. So they're absolutely connected and have great significance of the beginning and closing of kind of this tshuva, this repentance time for the Jewish people individually and even as a community at times.
Is there a difference between how Rosh Hashanah is celebrated by Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews?
Well, certainly, like all holidays, I think that Orthodox Jews, for example, many, not all, but many, and I would say most, don't use a car, don't drive to synagogue. They'll walk. Oftentimes, the Orthodox community will live near its synagogue, and maybe more progressive Jews will drive. That could be a difference. Also, length sometimes, depending on how the cantor sings or how long the sermon is, but also what it's included in the service. So an Orthodox service could tend to be a little bit longer. But again, that varies also from synagogue to synagogue.
Well, there's one more thing I have to ask you about, and that is the shofar. Tell us about that.
Sure. The shofar is comes from a biblical reference to the binding of Isaac, the ram's horn. So it is actually a ram's horn. And its sound kind of sounds like a trumpet calling the people in and the Jewish people at this time and kind of proclaiming our passion for the Jewish people and our acceptance in one God.
Hmm. Do you remember the first time you celebrated Rosh Hashanah?
I remember the first time my High Holidays. I have a great story in which the rabbi of the synagogue was preaching and he said, "You have to say to yourself, I'm a Jew, I'm a Jew, I'm a Jew." And my parents, who sat in the back their entire lives until their son became a rabbi, little three-year-old Jeremy screamed out from the crowd, "I'm a Jew too." So that was the first time I remember the High Holidays.
That's Jeremy Fine, who is senior rabbi at Temple of Aaron in St. Paul, Minnesota. And full disclosure, college classmate of mine. Rabbi, great to talk to you. Thanks so much and have a great holiday.
You too, Jeremy. All the best.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.